The following is a Bachelor of Arts production.
Previously on The Supporting Act.
I don't know what it's like to be Kanye West, but I could imagine that there's probably a lot of ego involved.
This week on a very special Supporting Act.
I'm relatively lucky that I've never had any big hits on.
You're listening to episode number 46 of the Supporting Act podcast, in which I make a phone call to Canadian recording artist Bahamas. Stay tuned, you might learn something. Welcome to episode number 46 of The Supporting Act. My name is Matt Moskal. I'll be your host. I'm a musician by trade, a journalist by education, and
I'd go the whole wide world, I'd go the whole wide world just to find her. I'd go the whole wide world, I'd go the whole wide world to find out where they hide her.
If you're unfamiliar with the show, this is the program where we shine a light to illuminate the careers of comedians, musicians, and artists just shy of the mainstream spotlight. We bring it to you for free every Wednesday on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, as well as Liberated Syndication, ShowbizMonkeys.com, and on Tumblr. And we air it every Sunday at midnight on 101.5 UMFM in Winnipeg, Manitoba. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about the content on this show, you can email me at tsapodcast@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at tsapod. Our show is available for subscription on iTunes. You can drop by there. If you enjoy the show, leave us a few comments, a couple of stars, let us know what you think. The Supporting Act podcast will be coming to you live from the Park Theater on November the 18th of 2014. It will feature performances by Mobina Galore and Roger Roger, and it will also feature Tim Gray and Dana Smith, as well as special guest host Corey Falvo and an appearance by Dan Goldberg's 30-second podcast. So all of that will be happening on November the 18th at the Park Theater in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Tickets and posters are available very soon. We once again have the very talented Kevin Mosden down at the Park Theater making our artwork, as well as doing just a fantastic job supporting this show. So if you have a chance, buy that man a drink or give him a round of applause. It might scare him, because the idea of applause out of context is actually pretty terrifying. Sound of my guest this week, Bahamas. Singer-songwriter Afi Yurvinen has been performing under the moniker for the past 5 years, ever since the release of his debut record, Pink Strat. Not only was it his first solo record, but it was also his first time being nominated for the Polaris Prize longlist, as well as a Juno Award. The Barrie, Ontario native released his second album, Bar Chords, in 2012 to critical acclaim on the Brushfire Records label, which was founded by singer-songwriter Jack Johnson.
I got all the time in the world. Don't you want some of that?
Critics from Uncut to Exclaim are already raving about Bahamas' latest release, Bahamas is Afi, which was put out in August of 2014. The subsequent tour has already resulted in a number of sold-out shows. Bahamas hit Winnipeg, Manitoba on the 23rd of October 2014, giving me an opportunity to speak to Afi leading up to the gig over the phone from the UMFM studio. And what follows is a conversation about growing up in Barrie, Ontario, being a supporting player and making your way to the forefront. We also get a bit into the concept of writing music for people to dance to and how folk music doesn't always strike the right chord in that department. So without further ado, let's go now to my conversation with Canadian singer-songwriter Afi Irvinen, otherwise known as Bahamas.
I'm a little bent out of shape here. I just found out the guy who played the sax solo in the song Baker Street just passed away, so that's a little bit depressing.
Oh my gosh, I'm not familiar with that song.
You're not familiar with Baker Street?
No.
Oh goodness. It's the big Jerry Rafferty hit, the
right. Yeah, I didn't know it by title, but yeah, I've heard that song. Well, that's bad news. I'm sure he played on off a good recording.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that's kind of the thing. He's sort of a bit part sort of player in a sense. I think he got paid like £7 to do that whole bit. So I really wanted to talk a bit about, so essentially I wanted to know how, if you feel that, music, personally, is more of a selfish or a selfless act, actually.
Well, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I don't really think of it in terms like that exclusively. I think when I write songs, it's very selfish, you know?
Yeah.
I'm the only one present. I have complete authority over what it is I create. And furthermore, I have complete authority over what I show to people. And that part of it is very selfish. I mean, I write a lot of songs that no one will ever hear, you know? And that's part of the process. And I would say for me, as far as being an artist, you know, writing songs, that's my favorite part. And, perhaps it is connected to the fact that it's just such a solitary pursuit. I'm sure it's, you know, tied up in ego and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, I think, you know, I'm sure I'm not revealing anything to you, but, you know, when you play shows, I think there's a real opportunity to commune with people, and I don't think it's necessarily selfless, but I do think it's about something much more than just one person, you know? And some shows, it's hard to sort of break that wall down, and other shows, for whatever reason, it's, you know, the audience is right there with you, and so, I don't know, I think as a artist and as a performer, you're kind of always going for that elusive thing, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. Do you consider yourself a competitive person?
Yeah, I'm pretty competitive. I don't know. When I was younger, I played a lot of sports. I was really in athletics and stuff before I started playing music. And
yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think that's good. And as far as the arts go, a lot of my friends are just some of the most talented songwriters and musicians I know, you know? So I think that can have a really good effect for me. I've always tried to surround myself with people that are better than me.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think right now I have a guitar player in my band who's infinitely better than I am. I'm always, you know, every night I'm in awe of her playing, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that pushes me, you know, that sort of competitive part of it pushes me to try harder, to try and dig deeper, to try and like, play something that I haven't necessarily played before, you know, take risks, so to speak. And I think that part of competition is a good thing, you know what I mean?
No, for sure. I mean,
yeah.
That sort of, that desire to, whether it be to be on the same playing field as somebody else or simply just to grow personally, right?
Yeah, that's I guess that's what I mean. I mean, it can, as far as, you know, the popularity contest, you know, that portion of it is, well, it's not really up to me anyway, so I don't spend too much time worrying about that portion. But as far as creativity and music, I think it's much better to be challenged inspired by people who are performing at a really high level.
Yeah.
I think that sort of brings out the best in you. You know, I do believe that.
For sure, yeah. And now you're a self-taught guitar player, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the term self-taught is always a little weird to me just because, I mean, the fact is I didn't take any lessons per se.
No.
But, I mean, that's not to say that I didn't study. I mean,
yeah.
I listened to so much records and spent so much time trying to emulate sounds in an effort to try and figure out how, you know, certain sounds were done or certain chords and things like that. I mean, I would say that the bulk of my learning was this process of emulation. And then at some point you feel like you have enough tools in your closet, so to speak, to try and turn it around and do something original with those ideas.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of where the real challenge comes in. And I don't know. I wanted to take lessons. It wasn't available to me, you know? So my friends, when I was like 12, 13, some of my friends took lessons and they would come home from their lesson and I would just say, show me what you learned.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's a little bit misleading to say that I was like in a self-taught. It sort of suggests that I'm like some alone in some backwoods cabin, like.
Yeah.
Just figuring out the instrument all on my own. In reality, you know, it's like just being surrounded by music and other musicians. I mean, that's some of the best education out there, I think.
Yeah, for sure. It makes it a social experience as well, right? I mean, it's kind of why so many people adventure through, like, I guess it's sort of a nerdier example, but something like Dungeons and Dragons, why so many people enjoy sitting around a table together. You're sort of exploring your imagination, but you're doing it in a social way that's validating in a very personal, sort of psychologically sound level in some ways.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that sort of, you know, when I started playing music, I really sort of enjoyed it almost because it has that parallel thing when you're with sports or whatever, you know, there's camaraderie and there's, you know, there's sort of this gang mentality where we're going to get together and we're going to do something. And it's sort of about this communication. And if the communication is very clear and operating at a really high level internally within the band or within the team, I mean, that's kind of what you hope for. You know, you might have like big time star players and still have no chemistry. So
yeah,
absolutely. I think it's about the social dynamics within the group and how they kind of play out. You know?
For sure. Now, you sort of came into the public eye as a supporting member in other people's bands. When you first started playing guitar, did you set out to play like someone else? And did you think that you were going to be, you know, the sort of the front man from the get-go?
I mean, I was. I had my own bands in high school. I played in other bands. I just sort of was tried to play as much as possible. You know, I've been writing my songs for a long time.
Yeah.
It just so happens that nobody really cared about any of them until about 6 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe the quality wasn't as good or, you know, I probably was naive at the time and didn't realize sort of how hard it is, you know, to get anybody's attention.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've always been writing my own songs and having bands and things like that. And I just sort of, you know, I basically wanted to play music. And at the time, I had friends who were, you know, more active than I was, whether it was touring or recording. And I was really lucky to just be a part of those bands. And, you know, obviously some of them at different levels of success and visibility and everything. But, the quality of all of them was quite high, I thought, you know, and I still think so. And it's just sort of, I got caught up doing that for many, many years. You know, it just sort of became my job and it became, you know, seemingly what I was doing. And the whole time I was sort of writing songs and still, you know, working on my own thing, thinking about the aesthetic, you know, what kind of album do I want to make and this sort of stuff. So, I don't know. I think it takes a long time to come up with those decisions, and I'm just lucky that in that time while I was waiting and sort of working on my ideas, I was busy playing music.
yeah.
You know, with other people. And, yeah, those are very fond memories for me. You know, I'm not necessarily a nostalgic person, but, I'm quite proud of that music, and to get to be a very small part of someone else's thing can be very thrilling.
For sure. And it's also, it's like you said, it's a learning experience. You get to see how other people take on these challenges and, you know, you're not so, you're emotionally invested, but it's not, for example, it's not always your ideas that are getting crushed or rejected. It's, you're part of the process, but you're not necessarily, it's not your face on the record sleeve at that point in time, right?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely learn a lot. You learn a lot about your own ego and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I can tell you that playing with other people, the thing for me, the goal is just to make them happy.
Yeah.
It's not to make me happy, because if my objective was to try and satisfy all my musical needs within someone else's music, I would always fail, you know?
Yeah.
But if I can sort of contribute some small idea that someone's like, right on, that sounds great, keep doing that, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's literally that simple.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially when you're working on someone's album or something like that, I mean, for that person, they have so much investment into it, they're so close to it, that, you know, often they don't want someone to come in there and put too much personality on there. They just sort of, they want, you kind of have to be like a push-up bra or something. You know, it's just about a support role. It's not necessarily about some big, you know, being some big glamorous outfit and being worn on the red carpet. You're just kind of the underwear. That's a horrible analogy, but,
it's something.
Yeah.
It's a good thing this isn't an article. I mean, I would hate for Bahamas is the Underwear to be the headline, you know?
Yeah.
You're listening to The Supporting Act on UMFM as well as on iTunes and Liberated Syndication. My guest this week is Aith Yerbanin, otherwise known as Bahamas, and here's a cut off of his first record entitled Pink Strat. This song is called Southern Drawl.
I can't be at your beck and call. Life's so slow and heavy, it's like a southern draw. It don't seem worth your time if the two of us ain't one of a kind. I won't be another time.
But yeah, I kind of wanted to backpedal. I mean, when you were first playing music, like what kind of songs were you playing back then? I mean, there's a lot of words that get thrown around when it comes to your style. A lot of people say it's a lot of layers of simplicity. But I believe I read somewhere that you were really into Angus Young when you first started playing
guitar.
Sure,
absolutely. I mean, when you're 13 years old and learning how to play the electric guitar, like,
yeah.
What else are you going to be into? I mean, I love AC/DC. I still do.
Yeah.
I don't listen to it every day, but when it comes on, I mean, those are incredible recordings. Obviously, you know, tens of millions of people agree. They're wildly successful and, you know, just literally a classic rock band. So, I don't know. I mean, I thought that was so cool. And it's just like, I still don't really know how to do that. You know what I mean? It's simple music, but it's incredibly sophisticated. And I really appreciate things that have both of those qualities, you know, something that's sophisticated and developed and thought out, but is presented in a simple way. And I think that exists in rock music. I think it exists in hip hop. I think it exists in folk music. Yeah, I think if your intent is to communicate something to the listener,
yeah,
you know, there's a million ways you could do that, and there's a million things you could put in the way of between you and the listener, between the song and the listener. And so, you know, I appreciate things like AC/DC and other, you know, artists that are able to sort of achieve that with a really sort of direct method, you know.
Yeah, they're not sugarcoating anything. Their sexual metaphors are extremely light. The innuendo is made very obvious in a group like that.
Yeah, for sure. But also just the sound of it. You know what I mean?
Of course, yeah.
The lyrics are one thing, and to me, those are probably the most important thing. But you know, for myself when I'm writing, but as a listener. It's kind of funny how often, like, the lyrics I will only notice second. It's the melody, very important.
Yeah.
You know, the rhythm, sort of like, if there's a physicality to what you're listening to, if it makes you move in some way, I mean, that's, what an amazing concept to be able to construct something from thin air that causes another human being to move their body. I mean, that's like, that's amazing.
No kidding. Yeah.
If you just think of it that way as a concept, I mean, it's so beyond music. It's so beyond anything else. It's just like this really elemental thing, you know? So.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's something ancient in there and that I certainly can't figure out and will just remain in awe of, you know?
For sure. Do you remember the first time someone, was there like a lightning rod sort of moment when, you know, electricity struck the first time you saw somebody dance to one of your songs? Do you remember that moment at all?
Yeah, people try to dance to my. I feel like they try to dance. I don't know. I don't necessarily think of a lot of my songs as sort of dancing songs, but people do try, and I'm always flattered for sure. It's awesome, but
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would love to be able to write songs like that. You know, I wish they came easier to me, but I seem to sort of write more love songs I guess songs that are not necessarily reliant so much on the beat or the groove. They're more about the lyrics and the melody, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's good make-out music from personal experience. It's good. Put it on a mixed CD for someone you've got a crush on, kind of music. So far,
well,
is what
great.
I've discovered.
That's good company to be in, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Now, speaking of being in good company, like I was reading an article where you pushed a copy of a weather station album across the table to the journalist that was interviewing you, paying it forward there. I'm kind of curious about this because, you know, you do come from this athletic background and then, you know, you were sort of the supporting player for a lot of people for years. And now that you're, in the forefront, one of the big things about this podcast, a lot of it is sort of paying it forward to people that you think, others should notice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what sort of inspired, this idea of, taking a moment where, you know, it is sort of about yourself and making it about others. Where along the line did that sort of kick in for you?
Well, I mean, I appreciate you, you know, going to great efforts to make me sound like some incredibly generous artist and like it's my mandate. But I mean, I just like her album. That's all it is. It's not any more complicated than that. And I've done the same thing for other friends, you know, Doug Paisley.
Yeah.
Daniel Romano, guys that I know personally. I know them as human beings and I know their music and I can say that they're of the utmost quality. You know what I mean? So, it would be tough to go out on a limb and sort of endorse someone that I didn't know or whatever. You know, I think the truth is that right now there's a lot of great music out there. And it can be overwhelming for a lot of people, myself included. I don't really listen to a lot of new music, and I think that's probably a common position for most artists or creative people. And the reason is just because it's just overwhelming. There's just so much of it, you know. And if you're with a friend and they tip you off to something, that's usually an endorsement I can get behind, you know.
Right.
I just saw her play. I thought it was just great. It was very original and somehow timeless and seemed like it had been around forever. It had all the qualities of you know, music that I certainly look for. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure when I did that, it was part of a wider conversation. It's hard. I don't remember exactly who that was or, you know, how it went down, but I'm sure we were talking about music and I'm sure that, you know, the conversation of other people's music came up. I think it would be a little strange to just in the middle of an interview, you know, just pull out of someone else's CD. But I don't know. I mean, she's on this tour with us, you know, she's opening the show tonight. And so it's been a real thrill to, you know, become friends and make a lot of music together.
Yeah.
And her own music is just incredible. It's great.
There was a timeless quality to her music. What makes something sound timeless to you?
I think a big part of it for her is the voice. I mean, her voice is just is probably one of the most relaxed, natural voices I've ever heard. You know, there's no affectation. There's very little effects, if any, of any kind on the recording. And so it's almost like you're just, you know, you're laying down next to this person and she's singing right in your ear. And it's like, it's so intimate and, you know, and at times almost too intimate. And I think that's kind of like, has this really powerful effect.
Is intimacy something that you're also sort of looking to feel like you're sharing to a degree? Like when someone listens to your record, do you want them to experience a sort of intimate quality of the music as well?
I think so. I think when I'm sort of making the albums and producing the albums, I'm just sort of thinking about, you know, trying to make someone feel something. And there's only a few very, very sort of big, broad emotions. And, you know, either you're happy or you're sad or you're excited, you know, those are the reasons why people put on music.
Yeah.
Because they're searching to connect with the feelings that they're already feeling, you know? So I guess, you know, knowing that I can't necessarily make people dance in a positive way, you know, I don't have the Ace of Base or AC/DC qualities. I sort of try and use the lyrics and the melody to try and pull something out of the song that people can sort of see themselves in, or, you know, see some reflection of themselves in, and hopefully find something that resonates.
Yeah, I find talking to a lot of musicians, the more you look inward and find something specific about yourself, the more people can relate to that. Have you ever written about something you thought was so personal and only to discover that it was something that was actually very relatable?
I mean, I think that almost all of my songs could be described that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I first and foremost, I generally tend to write in the first person.
Yeah.
Just because I feel most comfortable singing that way, even if it's not necessarily inspired by my situation, if I'm observing my friends or my family or whatever, or if I'm, you know, maybe remembering something from my life, but necessary, I might be filtering it or something,
yeah,
to suit the song or to suit my story or whatever. You know, I think I'm always kind of doing that. It's just like, to me, it would be much more difficult to create something from thin air, you know, that a story that just doesn't exist at all. Something I know nothing about. Those are much harder songs to write for me. I feel like someone like Gordon Lightfoot is like, you know, he seems to be able to do that. He can read a newspaper article and write a song about it, and it's moving, and it tells a story, and there's a narrative, and there's, you know, all the things that you would want out of a song. But it's not his story. It's someone else's story. And whenever I hear songs like that, I'm always kind of like, wow, that's incredible, you know? Because it's not something that comes naturally to me. It's much more often that I sort of move towards lyrics and themes and ideas that are, you know, really in the first person about my own experiences.
Yeah. Well, you've had so many opportunities to just live life before finally projecting, you know, an amplified version of self through your own personal material, right?
Well, I mean, I've had just as much as opportunity as any other 33-year-old person living in, you know,
that's true.
Relative security and Western civilization. I don't know. I mean, of course, my experience is unique, but you know, it's not unlike many other people's experiences. I grew up in Barrie, Ontario.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that people that grew up in Oshawa and London, Ontario and Peterborough.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these places, you meet people and they had really similar experiences when they were kids and really similar experiences in high school. And then everybody kind of goes through this period where some people go off to university, some people stay behind, other people meet a girl and they move out west or something, or,
yeah,
you know, I mean, those types of similarities are easy to find, I guess. And so for me, I don't know. I'm not to devalue my experiences or my history, but you know, it's,
of course,
yeah. I would say the bulk of my adult life, you know, since my early 20s, I've just been playing music.
Yeah.
You know, and playing music professionally, it's like, I when I was a teenager, I fantasized about how can I play guitar for the rest of my life with all these, you know, idealistic visions of what it would be like. And of course, none of those things have come to fruition, but the reality is even better. You know, I get to play guitar, I get to travel around with my friends, and, you know, we spend most of our time joking around, and it's just like, It's just fun.
Yeah, you're in so many ways living that dream. I guess what I was sort of getting at there was there's this whole cliche that gets tossed around about you have your whole life to write your first record and then only a few months to write your second one, and that gets tossed around a lot in the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you know, you were in your mid to late 20s when Pink Strat was released and you brought yourself to the forefront. So, I mean, in a way, I sort of interpret that as you had an opportunity to experience being a musician without having to worry about everything being about your ego, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that's unknowingly by design. I don't think there's any other way that I could have done it.
You know,
it's just like my ambitions and stuff, they've never been so clear. It's never been like, okay, this is what I have to do.
Yeah.
I have to meet this person to get introduced to this person, and then I got to play this show. And then, you know what I mean? Like the latter as an artist, it's not clear. It's not like some other profession where you go to university and then you get an apprenticeship and you get, you know, you do a summer internship and then you get hired on as a junior staffer or whatever. It's like,
yeah,
that does not exist. Every artist that I talk to, their stories are completely their own. They're, the way that they've kind of come to fruition is completely their own. You just kind of bump around.
Yeah.
And you hope that the places that you bump around, you know, you hope that you run into good people and along the way. A lot of people don't. You know, they have really negative experiences, and sometimes they give up and just say, I'm not going to do it anymore. You know, this is not, it's not worth it for me. Because, you know, they had expectations and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm relatively lucky that I've never had any big hit songs or anything. I mean, I've never really felt pressure, any more so than the one I sort of put on myself.
Yeah.
But you know, I work with really great people. They're really supportive. As far as making records, I do literally get to do whatever I want. And I don't know. I mean, that's the luxury. That's kind of one of the only luxuries I have, you know?
Yeah.
Is the artistic luxury. And yeah, I don't know. It'd be nice to have a hit song. You know, it'd be nice to renovate the bathroom and everything. But
yeah,
at the same time, you just kind of, you just can't. I'm just happy to be an artist and get to sort of do what it is I do, you know?
You're listening to The Supporting Act on either 101.5 UMFM or on the internet on iTunes, Liberated Syndication, Stitcher Radio, etc. My guest this week is Afe Yervanen, otherwise known as Bahamas. This is a cut off his latest record, Bahamas is Afe, called Stronger Than That.
Out in the hell does one heart swell to the size of a beast with a bark like a big kick drum? Tell me, what does it take to get a mouth that makes every old man around you seem so young? And I know you're afraid of falling flat. And I know those walls are up against your back. And I know there are those who see a crack. But I know that you're strong. Feeling bad, wave your hand at a cab and hitch a ride to the other side of the town. I'll be standing there to pay the taxi's fare and lend an ear, dry the tear of a friend who's down. And I know you're afraid of falling flat. And I know whose walls are up against your back. And I know there are those who'd see a crack, but I know that you're stronger than that.
You're from Barrie, Ontario, as you were saying earlier, which is a city many regard to be very working class. I remember going to like Warp Tour in Barrie, Ontario, and people mm-hmm. and people saying like, you know, hello Toronto. Like it's sort of an ignored part of the map in so many ways.
I agree.
Yeah. How was life in Barrie? First of all, how long were you in Barrie for?
Well, I grew up there, spent my entire youth there. You know, since I was a baby till about 19 or 20. And then me and a bunch of other guys, and we all moved to Toronto around the same time. And, you know, guys I played music with in high school, I still play music with them. They have a band called Zeus.
Okay.
I mean, we played music together when we were 15 years old. And, I mean, I don't know. I'm quite proud of the fact that I still see see those guys, I'm close to those guys, and we still play a lot of music together in one way or another, you know. It's,
yeah.
It's kind of amazing. But, you know, that being said, I think we very quickly found each other.
Yeah.
And then we kind of looked around to see who else was out there, and there wasn't too much else happening. And so I'm sure, like a lot of, you know, creative people who are in sort of smaller communities, eventually you just kind of, you start looking outside of your city, and Toronto just happened to be the closest place for us, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I think as far as being a kid there, it was fantastic. I mean, we were always out on riding our bicycles and going fishing and stuff. I mean, it was a small town at that time. Now it's not really. It's like 150,000 and unfortunately, I think it's kind of become homogenized. It's a lot like other towns of the same size, you know?
Yeah. Well, growing up for me, like whenever we'd go through Barrie, it was never, we never really got to see the suburbs or anything, around there. We would, you know, you'd pass through Barrie, but you'd go off a strip of highway that would lead you into nothing but chain restaurants and big box stores, and then you'd be, you know, pulling back out on the highway, and Barrie never felt like it had, a personality just from how homogenized it had become, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that's fairly accurate, but you know, I can say when I was a kid there, we lived downtown, obviously the whole city is sort of wrapped around this beautiful lake.
Yeah, which is amazing.
You know, when I was like 9 years old, I didn't care about any of that stuff. I just thought, this is so awesome. We were just at it all the time. I mean, it was great, you know? I love that, and I don't know. It's to me, that's really important, you know? I feel like maybe that's sort of changing now and becoming something else, and it's hard to assess what it is that's unique about a place like Barrie, but, you know, I think there is a lot of good people there. There was when I was living there, and I'm sure there still are, even though I'm not necessarily close to that place anymore, you know?
Do you ever pay it a visit? It's just down the road?
Well, my brother lives there, and my mother lives outside of town. She lives in the country, 20 minutes north of Barrie, so...
Yeah.
I don't really spend too much time there unless I'm hanging out with my brother or my family, you know? So that's a fairly one-sided experience. But yeah, you know, I go there.
You said in a past interview that free time is a very precious thing, and that with the newest record, the one you released this year, Bahamas is Afy, that you tried to afford yourself that luxury as much as possible. Now I think I've got a hint just from the people that you're working with how the studio process is, but. You know, what exactly goes into a recording experience for you? Is it just a simple, we're going to get everyone together and we're going to have fun recording this? Or is it something that has a lot of strategy behind it?
Well, I've done both. I don't know. I mean, my first two albums were, very much the former. It was by design. I didn't want to rehearse very much.
Yeah.
You know, or at all, in most cases. I spent a lot of time writing the songs, and after that, I just sort of assembled musicians whose instinct I trust, and basically just count out the song. And in some cases, you know, we'd use the first take. I know I'm not the first person to do that. I think that when you do it that way, what you're trying to capture is the intensity and the spontaneity and the energy of that moment when all the musicians are just literally on the edge of their seats trying to figure out what's going on, trying to figure out their role in it. There's something really special that happens in that moment, and it can only be captured in the infancy of when the song is being played, you know?
Yeah.
So you have, you know, one or two or maybe three takes before it starts to become rehearsed. And it starts to take on these other qualities, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I might say my first two records, I definitely was going after that type of energy more than anything else. You know, I think if you go in with no expectations, you're going to have some nice surprises along the way, you know?
Yeah.
For this new album, it was kind of the opposite. I spent a lot of time writing the songs and working on ideas, and first time I did demos, so I recorded drums and I recorded all the instruments and just sort of built up these tracks
with
with all these ideas that I had. And so when I went down to come to the studio, it was more about sort of recreating these ideas with, you know, a much higher fidelity and a precision and, you know, executing them properly as opposed to just sort of getting them down, just getting the ideas down sort of thing. So, yeah, it was a completely different process for me, and I don't know, I really enjoyed it. I feel grateful that I get to do both of those things, you know?
Yeah. What is the least that you've worked with somebody before, for example, playing on stage with them or having them on a record? You talked a lot about sort of the infancy of an idea and like and bringing and doing things in just one or two takes. I agree. I think that's such a neat way to bring out the personality of a player is to not prompt them to do, just give them a bit of direction and then see how it sounds. What's sort of the shortest period of time between, you know, maybe rehearsal to performance that's ever occurred in your career?
A matter of hours.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I'm constantly doing that. You know, like we had an emergency on this tour, and my drummer had to leave in the middle of the tour, and so we were wondering like, okay, what are we going to do? And I called my friend Darcy, and he plays the bass. And I looked at my guitar player, Christine, and I said, okay, you're going to play drums. We're going to fly Darcy in. I called Darcy. He was like a hired assassin just waiting by the phone. And I said, listen, I need you to deploy right now.
Yeah.
We got a gig tonight in Portland, Oregon. He was in Toronto. So he got on a plane, flew out to Oregon. And, you know, no rehearsal. We just kind of went for it.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing. I mean, my guitar player obviously knows the songs, but she'd never played the drums on all these songs. Turns out she's a fantastic drummer.
Wow.
And we were able to kind of like do something that was, totally different, but also, you know, the integrity of the song and the melody and everything was intact. You know, I wouldn't say we had to make any compromises. It was actually just like a totally different thing, you know?
Yeah.
And, I don't know. I mean, I those are the situations you can't plan for. But when they happen, you just kind of have to roll with the punches, you know? I kind of think like I'm lucky that I'm in a position to do that because I think that a lot of bands, they have their show. It's rehearsed a certain way. It's designed to be performed very consistently night after night.
Yeah.
And if all of the, you know, the venue and the setting and everything, if everything's not, you know, perfect, then it doesn't come out right. It's like, you know, I would think of like Lady Gaga or even like Metallica or something like that. It's like, you know what I mean? It's very rigid. What they're able to do, it's like, it's amazing, but it's kind of like there's clear boundaries on either side of what they're able to do. And I think it's kind of, for me, it's been really fun and exciting and interesting to just sort of try and be open to whatever.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in that process, you can kind of discover all kinds of things that there's no way that you could plan for it, you know?
Yeah. One of my favorite conversations I've had in years was with, Damian Abraham from Fucked Up. We talked a bit about how when they got signed to Matador Records, he just wanted to go through like the whole roster and just collaborate with every, band on the label. And I'm just kind of looking at the roster here for, Brushfire Records. I mean, is there at all a temptation there just to see, you know, to put things together with random people in that Rolodex and just see what works?
I don't know. I mean, the only person that I really know is Jack Johnson. We've spent a lot of time touring together.
Yeah.
We certainly have played a lot of music together and, you know, there's mutual admiration there. So, you know, I don't think it's inconceivable to think that we might do something together one day, but truth be told, I'm not really familiar with the other acts or specifically their music. You know, I'm most of those guys from California or from Australia or, you know, and I'm from Toronto. So,
yeah.
I mean, I only really know Jack because we've hung out and we spend a fair amount of time together. Otherwise, I think it would be even difficult for me to sort of see the parallels between us our music and what we might do together. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to envision that. I don't really like spend any time thinking about it really. So
no, not really.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's really not that calculated, you know. The Brushfire thing worked out because I met those guys and we got along really well. We went surfing and we were, you know, after we'd hung out two or three times, they were just like, "Hey, we should put out your album." And yeah, I don't know. I think if I was more ambitious or if I had more of a ruthless sort of business acumen, I would have deliberated and tried to get other labels interested or whatever. But the truth is that they were the ones that were interested. And now in hindsight, I mean, I couldn't be happier. I think that the people there are fantastic. I think that they're involved with a lot of initiatives beyond music, you know, environmental initiatives and all kinds of cool projects, that I think that are in a lot of ways more important than music. So, it's turned out to be a really great home for me, and they're nothing but supportive. And, I'm really sort of proud to be associated with their label.
I usually like to just close the show off with a recommendation or two. Do you have anything that you think people should be checking out? Anything, you know, other than
music-wise?
Yeah, of course, or books or anything like that.
Oh, books, fantastic. I am so wrapped up, and I've been reading like a fiend the last couple of weeks. I read this great new Murakami book.
Okay.
Suzuki, what the heck is the title? It's got some really funny title. Anyway, it's his brand new book, and it's fantastic. It's really good. I just started this series called My Struggle by Carl of Nosgaard. He's a Norwegian guy, and it's a 6-volume, basically an autobiography, but it's written like a novel. So he, you know, he's writing in the first person, and he plays himself, and his dad is his dad, and his wife is his wife, and his kids are his kids, and he's a writer in the book, and, you know, he just sort of writes about the minutiae of his life, and somehow, I don't know, it's the most engaging thing I've read in a long time, and I'm on book 2, and I just went to a shop yesterday and bought book 3.
Oh, that's the best
motivation
feeling,
to plow through the rest of this, you know, in the next couple of days.
That's how I went through all the Bukowski novels, was just, this just happened quickly, and now it's over with.
Yeah, fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and looking forward to your performance here in Winnipeg on Thursday. And
yeah, we'll see you in a couple days.
Yeah, cheers.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Would it shock you, baby, if I said I felt the same? Would you share with me some of your doubts? Would you let me help you if I could help you out? I couldn't give you all that you wanted. I couldn't even give you half of what you wanted if I wanted to. Be my witness. Be my something.
that I can't hurt. Be my witness. Be my bride. I'm on the edge of something. I'm on your side.
So that's our show for the week. Thank you so much to Afi for joining me over the phone for that conversation. If you are downloading this episode the day it comes out, Wednesday, October 22nd at the Broadway Theater in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Bahamas are performing. They're also performing on Thursday, the 23rd of October at the Burton Cummings Theater in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Saturday, the 25th at the Triple Rock Social Club in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and then they'll be hitting the road again on November the 5th at the Danforth Music Hall in Toronto, Ontario. On Thursday, November the 6th, they'll be performing at Metropolis in Montreal, Quebec, and then the Theatre Grenada in Sherbrooke, Quebec on Friday, November 7th, and then Saturday, the 8th of November, they will be performing at Imperial de Quebec in Quebec City in Quebec, Canada, before going overseas to the United Kingdom to perform a string of dates, and then traveling across Europe, it seems, for the remainder of 2014. For more details, visit www.bahamasmusic.net. And you can also download a copy of Bahamas is Afi from that website. Also, you can follow Bahamas on Twitter at Bahamas Music. So that about does it for the show this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Matt Moskal. You can follow the show at TSA Pod. Like us, subscribe to us on iTunes. You can check out our Facebook page. We're listed as the Supporting Act Podcast on there. You can also subscribe to our Tumblr. We're working on the website, so we're getting something together there. I think I'm going to use squarespace.com because that's what every podcast needs to do, what with all the sponsorships they hand out. And other than that, we're going to be doing a live episode November the 18th at the Park Theater in Winnipeg, Manitoba with Mobina Galore, Roger Roger, Tim Gray, and Dana Smith. Do not miss that event. Tickets will be available very soon. Our theme music and interstitial music is performed by Tyson Brinacombe. You can check out his latest record on labelfantastic.com. You can also check out the band you're hearing in the background now, NASA. Their latest record is entitled Losing Weight and was just released last month. You can check them out on Bandcamp, or if you're in the Winnipeg area, they play like every other day. So, I mean, that's going to just be a no-brainer on that one. As I record this, I've read a number of shocking headlines out of Ottawa and Winnipeg this week, and I don't think that this means that our country is going to hell. I think that hell is a state of mind that is all around us, all around the world, in some very select places at times, and in some very public places at others. And I think we have to be conscious of the way we treat one another. And we have to be conscious of people in situations that that drive them to such desperation. And rather than turn a blind eye, lend a helping hand, or find a way to ensure that these sorts of things are not commonplace anywhere. I mean, it's not just in your own backyard. It's everywhere. And it is shocking to see it happen in front of you, but there are people who deal with, you know, hardships like these every day. Just saying, take care of one another, support your local everything, and remember, everybody opens for somebody sometime. Matt Moskal, out.